You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Wisconsin Republicans are gearing up for a number of tight races this year. We talked to a political expert about the party's strategy for November and for 2020. First, the pursuit of followers on platforms like YouTube, Snapchat, and Instagram isn't just for popularity's sake. More people are trying to make their living as so-called social media influencers. By endorsing brands or businesses to their built-in audience, influencers are adding a new dimension to advertising, and that can mean changes for consumers as well. Taylor Lorenz is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers technology, social media, and internet culture. Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
There appears to be a rise in people actually making a living as social media influencers on platforms like Instagram. For those who actually do this as a job, where does that money come from?
Yeah, so social media influencers can make money a few different ways. One way is through selling sponsored posts. So we've all seen that with a lot of celebrities who also engage in this type of behavior online. You know, Kim Kardashian will do a sponsored post selling fit tea or whatever, you know, she's shilling at the moment. And sort of lower tier influencers can do the same thing. Another way that social media influencers make money is by sort of working with brands and producing branded content for them. This could be, you know, maybe partnering with Cole Haan and helping, you know, working on a sort of social media ad campaign with the company. And another way they, I wouldn't say they make money, but obtain goods and services is by working with brands to post about their products or services in exchange for free products or services. So, you know, if I'm a social media influencer and I'm working with a shoe brand, I could, you know, post a picture of me running or video and say, you know, love wearing my new, you know, at Adidas running sneakers, buy them, you know, at Nordstrom's Everywhere or whatever. And maybe I got those sneakers for free. Yeah, you can make a very good living this way, assuming you're popular enough online.
So who is popular enough online? What are the qualities how can you spot someone who has the potential to be a really successful social media influencer?
Yeah, so it can be literally anyone who has a loyal and dedicated following. And I when I say anyone, I mean anyone, like old moms, young teens, like people from every walk of life. There are business influencers, fashion influencers, you know, influencers in every single area. Anyone who could work with a brand, like, could be an influencer. Like, the most classic influencers you think of are, you know, fashion and lifestyle influencers, I guess. Those are sort of the most maligned. But it's the type of people, you know, with maybe a million Instagram followers and they're just a pretty girl and they post pictures of their outfits every day and they get free clothes. You know, those are sort of like the classic stereotypical influencers, but there's a lot of micro influencers. You know, say you are a, you know, young woman in Baltimore, with maybe only 3,000 Instagram followers, but you have a really loyal, dedicated following and a blog about things to do on the weekend in Baltimore. You know, you might be invited by a local hotel, for instance, to stay a night for free and, you know, document the experience in your Instagram stories because, you know, they know that your followers are, you know, going to be hyper-engaged in that type of content. So, you know, a lot of people think that you do need, like, a million followers to be an influencer. That's not true. I mean, you definitely have to have some sort of a threshold. You don't really see micro-influencers getting smaller than a few thousand because you do need, you know, some sort of audience. But yeah, it's a sort of a wide range.
Well, I'm hearing a couple different threads there, Taylor. So we've got a defined audience. So like you said, that hotel in Baltimore is probably more likely to establish a relationship with that influencer who talks about great things to do on the weekend in Maryland than they would with some national person that usually is talking about kitchen tools or something. So there's that. There's also, you did mention attractiveness, and there is, there's definitely evidence that being attractive, whatever that means to the audience, helps. But there's another element that I've heard talked about that I wonder about, and that's relatability. Because you say that, like, celebrities can be very
popular and effective as influencers, but I don't think of celebrities as very relatable.
Well, I think certain celebrities are very relatable. I mean, Chrissy Teigen, for instance, is sort of like a powerhouse influencer, and people like her because of her really relatable personality. But you're right in the sense that most celebrities, it's aspirational. And a lot of, I mean, I would say the lion's share of influencers are also sort of aspirational influencers. I think what makes them seem more attainable is the fact that they usually, or their lifestyle seem more attainable, is that they engage heavily with their audience. I mean, a lot of them are smaller and are more relatable in the sense that they're more casual. You know, celebrities, it's like you're never going to be able to get in touch with a celebrity directly. I mean, Chrissy Teigen's probably the exception, which is why she's so relatable, because she responds to fans on Twitter and Instagram a lot. But, you know, influencers spend an enormous time engaging with their audience, you know, taking feedback from followers. And so followers, and we've seen research sort of supporting this too, you know, people who follow internet celebrities who are more like YouTubers, for instance, huge YouTubers, they're more likely to view them as a friend. No matter, you know, that YouTuber could have 10 million followers like Jake Paul, and, you know, his fans still sort of consider him like a sort of a friend figure in their life, even though they don't know this person. So I think it's sort of true, especially with Instagram influencers. If the influencer is engaging, you know, regularly with their fan base, they can seem much more approachable and therefore relatable. And also, you know, a lot of these influencers sort of, you know, aren't living some fancy LA life. They're, you know, a lot of like mommy blogger influencers, for instance, you know, are regular moms in the middle of the country or wherever they may be. So, you know, it is, I guess they are just much more accessible in all those different ways.
Taylor Lorenz is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers technology, social media, and internet culture. And right now we're talking about the role of social media influencers. And, you know, one of the things, Taylor, that you wrote about is that, you know, there's basically no hurdle to announcing that you are a social media influencer.
Yeah.
And that this has actually caused problems for some businesses, because they are being flooded with these requests for, you know, say a free 7-night stay in a luxury hotel in Bali in exchange for 2 Instagram posts, which doesn't sound very good to them. But so how are businesses deciding if using social media influencers is worth it for their bottom line, because it's coming out of, you know, some kind of marketing or promotional budget?
Yep, absolutely. So, like, I mean, exactly what you mentioned, there really is no bar to sort of declaring yourself an influencer. And I think as this sort of class of people has emerged, you know, hotels especially have struggled to deal with it. I mean, a lot of industries are sort of struggling to figure out how to work these types of people sort of into their marketing programs. Because, you know, the best of them are very influential. And, you know, even a lot of the hotels that I spoke to who are sort of overwhelmed with this request were like, look, we still want to work with influencers. It's just, it's really hard to evaluate the ROI and especially evaluate the requests they're getting. So, you know, like I wrote in my story, I interviewed a bunch of luxury hotels that are sort of famously beautiful on Instagram. And so these are, you know, the insane resort in Bali or Malaysia, the types of place you might go on a honeymoon. And these influencers will just, you know, shoot an email, hi, I'm an influencer, like, I want this free stay. And the hotel is sort of left scrambling. I mean, sometimes it's worth it. You know, for instance, a very influential luxury travel influencer who, you know, regularly writes recommendations, you know, it might be worthwhile to give that person a free stay. What's really important is to determine, sort of set expectations ahead of time. So, you know, a hotel, I think a less sophisticated hotel might just let that person stay for free and kind of hope that they post positive things or, you know, see how it is. And I think hotels are now realizing that there needs to be sort of a agreed expectation on the deliverable. So, you know, they might say that influencer, all right, you know, maybe a 3-night stay and you need to post 2 Instagrams a day, Instagram stories. Also, we want you to take, you know, a photography for our marketing materials or, to, you know, shoot a video for us while you're on the property or sort of, you know, maximize their use and really put that person to work while they're on the property.
And Taylor, influencers are really meant to reach a younger demographic, especially those active on the social media platforms most used this way, like Instagram. But does their influence affect even people who are not their followers? Are they changing the landscape for all of us?
Yes. It's sort of crazy how, you know, social media has transformed, especially in-person experiences. There was an amazing piece in The Ringer last year on the concept of Instagram playgrounds, and it's basically little areas that are set up at events or hotels or really anywhere, concerts or around cities that are sort of meant for Instagram. So you'll see hotels now, you know, have a sort of like dedicated area of their garden that's very, you know, sort of primed for social media posting or pictures, and they're really thinking about they're really taking a more sort of like photography oriented approach to design, I guess, and knowing that even their own you know, guests may have influence among their friends, and so they want to make sure that they're, you know, they have good lighting in their lobby or whatever for photographs, and things like that are being taken into account. So it's really reshaped, I think, the world around us, not just hotels, in really kind of interesting and subtle ways.
Well, Taylor, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Taylor Lawrence is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering technology. She was with us to talk about how some people are now making their living as social media influencers. First, voters in Mexico elected a new president yesterday. Andrés Manuel López Obrador won with 53% of the vote. His closest competitor came in with 22%. López Obrador is described as a left-wing populist who's pledged to get tough on corruption, take a less aggressive and less militarized approach to drugs, and to be a champion for the poor. President Trump congratulated López Obrador on Twitter and said he looks forward to working with him. The two were to speak over the phone today. In an interview that aired yesterday on Fox Business Network, Trump raised the prospect of taxing cars imported from Mexico.
NAFTA, I could sign it tomorrow, but I'm not happy with it. I want to make it more fair, okay?
You can't do NAFTA before the midterms.
I want to wait till after the election. You're going to have an election. It's going to be very interesting. I have a feeling he's going to be fine. And the reason is because if they're not fine, I'm going to tax their cars coming into America. And that's the big one.
López Obrador will be sworn in on December 1st, so what might his presidency mean for NAFTA and U.S.-Mexico relations? Mark Jones is a professor of Latin American Studies at Rice University in Houston. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
So looking at the numbers, it was a pretty big victory for López Obrador, but not necessarily surprising, correct?
No, not at all. There was no surprise that he was going to be victorious. The major surprise was that he won by such a large margin, again up to 53%, and when we get to the valid vote, it'll be closer to 55. And that's a historic election for Mexico. In the modern democratic era, no president has crossed the 50% threshold, and López Obrador did it easily.
And who is he? This is not his first run for the presidency, right?
No, this is a case of the third time's the charm, in the sense that this is his third run. He ran in 2006, where he believed he was cheated out of the election. He ran in 2012, where he lost pretty resoundingly. And this is his third try, and this was the charm in the sense that he was able to present an alternative, a somewhat more moderate position than he had in the past. And he also was advantaged by the fact that the government of current president from the PRI, Enrique Peña Nieto, was a complete disaster. And thus, Mexicans were really looking for a change.
And according to a Reuters article, López Obrador's nationalism, his stubborn nature, one could say, and put-downs of rivals have actually drawn comparisons to how President Trump has kind of functioned in his role. Do you see that as a valid comparison?
Well, yes, in many ways, they're two sides of the same coin in the sense that they both are populist, and they both arrived at office with a rather unorthodox populist-type appeal. President Trump has done it a little more from the right, and President-elect López Obrador has done it a little from the left, but they definitely share that in common, and that could create some conflict in the future because populists always need an enemy, and one enemy that's out there is each other.
Mm-hmm. And So it feels like it could go either way, and maybe it's too early to be able to predict. There does seem to be evidence that President Trump likes and likes to deal with people who are also pretty strong personalities. But then you get into the point where if those two strong personalities conflict on something, it can go badly pretty quickly. What's your prediction, if you're willing to do that, about whether they can work together, or is it going to be a tense relationship?
I think it's going to probably be a tense relationship, in the sense that President Trump has a tendency to criticize, as does President-elect Lopez Obrador, and they both will escalate, and that neither is going to be willing to back down. Even the President Trump statement that was just played, the idea that he might place a tax on Mexican cars, will be seen as negative by Lopez Obrador. And both of them actually are very suspicious of free trade. That is, they aren't, unlike, say, their predecessors in both parties, but both Barack Obama and George W. Bush here, and Enrique Peña Nieto and Felipe Calderón in Mexico, both are not entirely convinced of the benefits of free trade, and they tend to view trade as a zero-sum game. And with that type of approach, it's going to be very difficult to come to any deals, because any advantage for Trump will be seen as a loss for by Lopez Obrador for Mexico, and vice versa.
We're talking with Mark Johnson. He's a professor of Latin American Studies at Rice University, and we're taking a look at yesterday's Mexican presidential elections and what they might mean for U.S.-Mexican relations on topics like trade, immigration, and others. And it's no secret that President Trump does not like NAFTA. He's called it the worst deal ever made, and he has slapped tariffs on steel and aluminum from Mexico and Canada. They, in turn, have responded with levies on American yogurt, toilet paper, whiskey, apples, pork, cheese, and other goods. What specifically did Lopez Obrador say about NAFTA during his campaign, and how important was that position?
Well, Lopez Obrador is somewhat skeptical of NAFTA, like President Trump, in that he views it as not being the best deal for Mexico. I think the best we can hope for related to NAFTA is that other actors will be able to maintain the agreement together and keep the two presidents, say, in their political or rhetoric warfare, from actually doing harm to U.S.-Mexico trade. So, I think we need to be cautious in that right now they haven't made any changes, but I think we also need, there will need to be people out there working to try to keep both presidents from doing anything that will harm trade between the two countries.
Well, and bringing it home here to Wisconsin, government figures show that under NAFTA, there's been a 1,005% increase in Wisconsin exports to Mexico, and that 96,000 jobs here in our state depend on that trade with Mexico. You know, if President Trump pulls the plug on NAFTA, as he has threatened to do, what might that mean for states like Wisconsin, who see a very definite benefit to the agreement?
Well, it would be bad news for Wisconsin, and it would be really bad news for us down here in Texas, where we're the largest trade partner with Mexico, and our economy is influenced the most by it. But for all states, generally free trade does benefit the country in general. It may not benefit some specific workers or specific industries, but by and large, the country as a whole does benefit from free trade. And if free trade is restricted or blocked, that will mean a loss of jobs in Wisconsin, Texas, and elsewhere through the country.
Switching to another topic that's of interest on both sides of the border, President Trump has said that drugs are part of the reason why he wants to build a border wall to stop that flow that he sees of drugs into the United States. President-elect Lopez Obrador says he's going to take a softer approach to fighting drugs, including an amnesty of sorts for some people who work with drug gangs. What do you see happening there when these two pretty different positions might collide?
I suspect the president isn't going to be entirely happy with President Lopez Obrador's policies, in part because for Mexico, there is some drug use at home, but the real problem is the violence that's associated with the cartels. And to the extent to which Lopez Obrador, through amnesty, modest legalization, and other programs, can bring that violence down, that resolves the principal problem that Mexico faces vis-a-vis drugs. And the real problem is always going to be, of course, consumption in the United States. As long as there's such strong demand for heroin, cocaine, fentanyl, methamphetamines, and other drugs here in the United States, there's always going to be someone in Mexico willing to take the risk to try to ship it here.
This issue of the wall has also been a big point of conflict between the U.S. and Mexico. President Trump very early on saying that not only would there be a wall, but that Mexico would pay for it. Mexicans feeling otherwise. What did the candidate, now President-elect López Obrador, say about the future of this wall?
Well, that the wall is seen by all Mexicans, but especially nationalists like López Obrador, as an affront to Mexican sovereignty and a real insult to the Mexican population. And you're going to get no cooperation whatsoever with the López Obrador administration if you keep focusing on a wall and effectively blocking off Mexico. If in the end the wall is more a symbolic aspect where we build a few miles of it and for a photo op and that's all that occurs, I think we'll be on good. There won't be too much in the way of disruption of relations. But if the president continues with the goal of trying to build the wall and making Mexico pay for it and keeps that up in a rhetorical perspective and PR perspective, that could create a real tense relations between the two countries, because López Obrador, unlike the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, is not going to back down. He's likely to double down instead and attack the president and be much more aggressive vis-a-vis the wall.
And briefly, Mark, as we start to wrap up, we have seen overall the number of people crossing illegally from the Mexico side of the border to the United States drop. But we have seen these waves of especially Central American immigrants trying to escape violence in their own countries and come to the border. What does that mean for Mexico, and what does the U.S. need to do to be good partners?
Well, net migration, as you mentioned, from Mexico is pretty much at zero. About as many Mexicans come to the United States as go back. The real issue are Central Americans from El Salvador and Honduras, particularly crossing through Mexico and then coming to the U.S. border. The United States would like the Mexican government to play a much stronger role in blocking those immigrants at their border down the south, as well as in the middle of the country. But I don't think López Obrador is going to do that, because that would be seen as essentially kowtowing to Trump.
And we'll leave it there. Mark Jones, thank you so much for joining us today. Mark Jones is a professor of Latin American Studies at Rice University. He joined us to talk about yesterday's presidential elections in Mexico. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Now, we talked last week about how Wisconsin Democrats are strategizing for this year's midterm elections and the next presidential race in 2020. Today, we're focusing on Republicans. The GOP's made undeniable inroads in the state since they flipped the state legislature 8 years ago. That's also the same year Governor Scott Walker won his first of three elections for governor, including an extremely contentious recall. But those same gains mean Republicans have a lot to protect over the next few years. Eleanor Powell is the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a faculty affiliate of the Elections Research Center. She's with us now in the studio to talk about state Republican strategy headed into the next few elections. Eleanor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in general, this is something I've been thinking about a lot. How does messaging by the party in power and incumbents differ from those that are challenging them?
Well, one of the biggest challenges facing, I would say, the president's party, because usually that's what we think of during midterm elections, is the decision about how much to try to distance themselves from the president versus how much to sort of align themselves with the president. One of the strongest empirical regularities with elections is that the president's party almost always suffers electoral losses in the midterms. And so the Republican candidates are going to face a tough decision about sort of what to do about that. How much do they stay close to a president who's very popular with their party versus how much to try to distance themselves from a president who might not be as popular with swing voters?
It does seem that, while that I know is true, that the party in power tends to lose some ground in the midterm elections, it does seem that this time around, feelings are so strong one way or the other about the current president and about his policies that there's got to be a little more fear and jockeying to figure out what the right path is.
It's a tough challenge because the president is very popular with the Republican base voters, and Republican candidates need their base voters to show up enthusiastically and turn out for the election if they're going to win. But they also need to appeal to the swing voters who are much less enthusiastic about the president. And so if they distance themselves too much, the base won't turn out. But if they don't distance themselves, the swing voters will stay home and certainly won't vote for the Republican. And so it's a really difficult strategic choice that they're facing.
So we have seen some pretty interesting primaries, and those will be continuing through the summer. What kind of messaging are we hearing from Republicans this year as they try to set a narrative going into those midterms?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the strong economy and about the tax cuts, about the sort of things that are more popular with the Republican base and with what they think might be swing voters. And so that's a lot of their push. They're also talking about, at least in Wisconsin, education, which has, you know, been shown as a top campaign issue for among voters in Wisconsin. And so they're trying to sort of push these messages that might appeal to both sides, both their base voters and the swing voters. But it's a difficult challenge.
Well, and as you said, Eleanor, often, especially going into midterms, it's how much you align yourself with the policies and the positions of the president if you are in that dominant party. Bringing it to the state level, we have Governor Walker, who, while not as polarizing as Donald Trump, certainly inspires strong feelings from either end of the spectrum. So how do we see that in more of a microcosm in Wisconsin playing out, as you talked about, on that macrocosm of the national level?
You see a very similar thing playing out at the state level, the decision to whether to align themselves strongly with Governor Walker, who, as you say, is very polarizing within the state of Wisconsin. He's a little more popular than the president within the state, but there's not a huge difference there. And so Republican candidates, when they're thinking about statewide politics, are faced with a very similar challenge. How much do they sort of align themselves as sort of Walker Republicans versus sort of try to chart their own path, build their own brand to attract voters sort of within their district, try to appeal to issues that are, you know, of particular concern to their local voters.
There's also certainly on the national level, with President Trump having come in, I believe I'm getting this right, that he was the first person elected as president who had neither a political nor a military background. So really about as outsider as you could get. Are we seeing that in any of the messaging for people who are coming from outside of kind of the party insider circles and trying to present themselves in a similar way?
This is actually a long time political strategy that tends to work really, really well. So people typically try to run for Washington, run for Congress by running against Washington or by running as
an outsider no matter what.
No matter what. We've seen this has always worked regardless of how authentic their outsider credentials are. Candidates usually try to position themselves as authentic folks from Wisconsin, from the district, and not a part of the sort of corrupt Washington that's very unpopular.
So that is nothing new and probably something that we will see in this election, as you're saying, we always do.
Certainly.
So that's one of the ways that the messaging is going to be similar. You know, they're coming into, you know, whatever phrase people want, drain the swamp, clean out Washington. Are we seeing any different messages or different tones to messages this year than we would have maybe in past elections?
You know, we're seeing a lot of the same themes. You know, people are concerned about the economy. People are concerned about jobs, these sorts of things that, you know, come up every election cycle, education. You know, there's some different themes that we're seeing this year that haven't often been as much of a concern are things like tariffs and immigration aren't always big issues in the midterm. And those certainly have been, you know, more widely discussed this year.
We're talking with Eleanor Powell right now. She's the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. About a week ago, we took a look at Democratic strategies going into the midterm elections and into 2020. Today, we're looking at Republican strategies and what they'll need to do to keep a majority in the Wisconsin legislature, to hold the Wisconsin governor's seat, and more. And, you know, one of the big issues you mentioned that Governor Walker recently came out saying that he was the pro-education governor. What is he pointing to, and what are other Republican candidates pointing to as their credibility on education?
Well, they're trying to, you know, point to some new initiatives they have, some additional money that they're trying to send to schools and local school districts from the state. It's a somewhat challenging sell, I think, for voters who have been paying attention to education in the state for over the last several years of the larger arc of the Walker administration, given the size of the cuts to education throughout the state over that time period. But that's certainly been a big recent push.
Hmm. And what about other issues that Republicans are planning to run on this year or might already be kind of putting those messages out?
Well, certainly within the state, the big Foxconn plant, bringing Foxconn to Wisconsin. Now, that's a somewhat complicated campaign issue. Obviously, the polling suggests the voters in the state are somewhat divided over whether they think the state's investment in terms of tax breaks for the company was worth it financially relative to the cost. And so there's a little bit of a risk there, but certainly at least Republican-based voters are very optimistic, and they're certainly part of the larger story they can tell about bringing jobs to the state of Wisconsin and the sort of low unemployment numbers we're seeing here.
How do you see Republicans countering what often gets spun as a very positive thing, that we have extremely low unemployment in Wisconsin right now? On the other hand, the governor and other Republican leaders are really touting, you know, bringing businesses like Foxconn here, all these new jobs, whereas we've got business owners who are often, you know, a pretty substantial part of the Republican base saying, hey, I can't find people to fill these jobs. And now, you know, now they're going to be these presumably good paying jobs, maybe down the road or down the highway from me. I can't find people to work for me. How are they going to maybe massage that message for the business community?
You know, it's an interesting challenge, and one that's certainly exacerbated by sort of if we see expected continued drop in immigration as well, that sort of lack of employees isn't going to change anytime soon. The sort of economics of this suggests that when that happens, wages should rise. And so I think that they're going to try to say, you know, appeal to voters more broadly who are the ones who have the votes, not the businesses, and sort of say, you know, look, unemployment is low. Hopefully this will put pressure on wages to rise because a lot of people haven't received a real wage increase in a long time. And so I think they're going to try to make that pitch. And for businesses, they'll say, well, at least the economy is doing well. And so we're giving big tax breaks. And so I think they'll try to send that sort of mixed message.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of a mixed message, the president was in Wisconsin last week for the Foxconn groundbreaking. That was also during a week that the president was very pointed in his criticism of Harley-Davidson for moving some of their manufacturing out of the country. How does someone like Governor Walker, who has, you know, portrayed himself and has been a very good ally to the president, that's about as tight a tightrope as you can find right there, kind of in the same day, in the same event.
It put the governor in a really difficult position. He's a longtime advocate of Harley-Davidson. I think he rides a Harley-Davidson. I mean, he's sort of that you know, put the division not just sort of economically in terms of the state, but also, you know, a personal conflict as well.
And it's an icon of the state.
And an icon of the state. And so, you know, if the president keeps up his barrage of criticism of Wisconsin companies, that's going to make it increasingly difficult for Wisconsin Republicans to stay loyal. They'll probably try to distance themselves on that particular issue and, you know, make some claim about the president not understanding the importance of the company in Wisconsin. But it's a challenging position for them to be in.
We're talking with Eleanor Powell, Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about Wisconsin Republicans' strategy for this year's midterms and 2020. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a Republican who's excited about the candidates running this year? Do you feel like the party is reaching out to your community and meeting your needs? Or maybe you're a Democrat feeling good about your chances to make up some ground this November? Or maybe you're an independent. Do you feel like you've seen candidates on either side who are talking about your issues? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the state GOP's strategy to protect their majorities this year and in 2020 with Eleanor Powell, Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 1234. What are the issues you want prioritized this election year? Do you see candidates in any party that are talking about them? Do you want to hear candidates support President Trump, or do you want to see them call him out on things that you don't agree with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to the phones, and Andy in Mount Horeb is up. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to say?
What I wanted to say is I'm a lifelong conservative, although I am definitely not a Republican. I did not vote for Trump, and I did not vote for Walker in the last election, and I will not be voting for them again. You can bet your boots on that.
So as a conservative, do you see or hear any candidates, whether in the state or on a national level, who speak to your values and your priorities?
Well, basically, I certainly like both of our senators. I think Tammy's done a really good job, and I think Mark is finally starting to get things done, too. So I voted for Mark Pocan, and I did vote for Tammy Baldwin last election.
So Democratic congressman and Democratic senator?
Yes, yes.
And what about Senator Johnson, who is a Republican?
I'd rather not comment on my feelings about him.
All right. Well, we'll let you go with that. Andy, thanks so much for calling. So, Eleanor, that's really interesting. Andy identifies strongly as a conservative, but he's not feeling represented by the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen voters in actually both parties being somewhat dissatisfied with their party's candidates over the last election cycle. And so this is sort of part of a larger trend that we've seen.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Eleanor, obviously, when a party is not in power, as the Democrats are not in Wisconsin right now, it's easy to target the party in power and say, this is what they've done that's not been good. This is what they haven't done that they should have. It's in a lot of ways much easier to message when you're in the opposition. How do the Republicans, we talked a little bit about what they'll point to as their successes, but there must be a part of the Republican strategy that's also casting doubt on the ability of the Democrats to do a good job. What kind of messaging might we see from Republicans that's aimed against the Democrats specifically?
Well, they might make an argument that the Democrats sort of don't have their act together within the state. They aren't sort of getting much done. That Democrats can't point to a lot of recent accomplishments for their voters or for sort of liberal policy achievements. I mean, I think one of the other things we'll see the Republican candidates talk about, you know, across the spectrum, is about, you know, the Supreme Court and about judicial appointments. Now, you know, as a technical matter, that really only is controlled by both the president and senators in terms of confirmation. So that might be an issue in Senator Baldwin's reelection. But, you know, often we see House members and, you know, Republicans, you know, candidate party members across, you know, up and down the ballot talk about the importance of those judicial nominations and confirmation for Republican voters.
It does seem quite common that parties who are in power say, oh, you know, the other party is really ineffective and they haven't gotten anything done. But when a party holds all three levels, whether it's at the national level or the state level, is that a very convincing argument when the other party really doesn't have the leverage?
It's a tougher argument to make. Usually in American politics, it's really difficult for voters to assign responsibility. The sort of structure of our government with divided government, all the branches and federal and state, makes it really hard for voters to, you know, reliably assign blame or credit. But this is a really unusual situation where we actually do have the Republicans control almost all the levers of power at both the federal and state level. Now, there's a little bit of exception. They don't have a, you know, overwhelming majority in the Senate. They control a majority, but that does make it a little bit difficult. They don't have a filibuster-proof majority, but that's sort of all they can point to is Democratic obstruction in the Senate.
Let's go back to the phones, and AJ in Madison is up. Hi, AJ.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi, what would you like to say?
I have recently heard a lot of talk about net neutrality and what the FCC has been attempting to push through the House and the Senate with that. What I haven't heard is a lot of local opinion on that. And I was wondering if our guests could speak to what some of the Republican representatives are leaning towards on that and whether or not there's anything that I can do as a voter to help salvage that.
All All right. Thanks for that. And just really briefly and not very specifically, net neutrality deals with the access to the internet and speeds in delivery of information and who kind of gets to control that. And certainly, I think, Eleanor, net neutrality was an issue that Democrats really hoped they could make some hay with and get people exercised about. And I don't think it's quite turned out that way. But there are voters like AJ who are concerned. What have Republicans said about that?
Well, there's the sort of Republican argument has largely been one about sort of economic freedom and then a corporate marketplace. You know, what we'll see is, you know, if voters, you know, if consumers really want, you know, an open internet, if they want that, then internet service providers will, you know, honor those sorts of wishes and provide internet access packages that will allow you to access the internet without higher rates for certain websites or, mm-hmm. you know, certain companies. We haven't seen the sort of rate change that were feared with the repeal of network neutrality. I believe it just took effect fairly recently in terms of companies being allowed to start making the changes. But if we do see those changes, you know, we could get some pretty unhappy voters between now and November. And, you know, generally, I would recommend that if you're really unhappy with the policies that are happening in Washington, this is, you know, more of a federal issue. But I'd recommend, you know, calling your House member, calling your senator, you know, even if they're Democrats who oppose this, make sure that they know this is a top priority for you. Sometimes voters, you know, they'll invest a little bit more effort in trying to, you know, make those repeal efforts happen.
Thanks for that call, AJ. Let's go next to Polly in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Polly.
Hi. Yeah, so I have identified as a Republican for much of my past, but I've been feeling, you know, moving away from the party. The party's moving away from me in a lot of different ways, I feel like, more than myself moving away from the party. But one big thing is that the Republicans' inability to address climate change as something that's happening. And, you know, part of that, I think the biggest part of that is the influence of, you know, the natural gas and coal industries trying to push money into that. And, there are a lot of conservative ways to address climate change, but when they're not able to accept the facts, they're not able to do that, and that makes me very mad.
Well, Polly, thank you so much. And Eleanor, I think Polly brings up a couple really interesting points. One is that he said he doesn't feel like he's moved away from the party, but the party has moved away from him. And it does seem like there's a lot of polarization on issues where maybe there was a little more give and take, maybe in previous elections. Does that ring true with you?
Certainly. There were used to be moderates in Congress in both parties. And, you know, those are pretty much a dying breed. And the Republican Party in particular has moved further right than a lot of its members and voters wanted. And so the caller certainly isn't alone in that feeling.
And just briefly, as we start to wrap up, the Wisconsin GOP party is well known for its political operation. What sets it apart as far as organization and effectiveness?
Well, it's known for, you know, having a better coordinated effort in terms of volunteers, in terms of fundraising, in terms of a sort of statewide operation. And so that's something that the Democrats are going to really have to work to make up, because they have so few statewide candidates and sort of such a little success at the statewide level. They've really fallen behind in terms of organization of volunteers.
Although this time around with the midterms and then certainly 2020, there is President Trump looming over it. That seems that, you know, the Republicans have their base already. It seems like the Democratic base is pretty fired up in opposing President Trump.
We've seen Democratic enthusiasm levels this year at sort of record levels in terms of voters being excited, in terms of a record-breaking number of Democratic candidates running for election and a lot of first-time candidates running. And so this may be the year where the Democrats are sort of able to out-organize the Republicans.
Well, Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us. Really great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
That was Eleanor Powell, Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us to look at Wisconsin Republicans' strategy going to the next two elections. We looked at the Democratic strategy last week.